Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Hi, welcome to an edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett. I'm here with my good friend, Fred. How's it going, Fred?
Hey, pretty good, Adam. And, you know, before we got started, we were chatting about a handful of different things and between wildfires and trying not to lose your watch and things like that. It's like, but one of the topics you threw out there intrigued me a lot. So I wanted to make sure we hit record and get on it. And it was, it's related to, I was deposed recently. And one of the first questions that I got was, am I familiar with confirmation bias? And I says, yes, I'm familiar with that concept. And then the interview went on from there. But when you mentioned that this idea of being ready to deal with field data, I mean, there's mechanical things and database things and, you know, stuff like that. But I think you meant a lot more than that. I think there's more of a cultural piece here somewhere.
Yeah, it's funny. People laugh when I try to describe this concept in a program. And I think I should just write an ebook called Data Starvation, Why Are You Doing This to Me? a book by a story from reliability engineering. And this is what I mean. And I use the word data starvation, you know, to get people's attention, because that's what it feels like. I mean, as somebody who likes data, works with data, reliability engineers, quality engineers, you do always feel data starved. I mean, that is the thing that is so frustrating, is you want to do this work to start to turn data into information. But with small data sets, the information is very loosey-goosey, right? You put a tremendous amount of assumptions in there. You're missing, you know, real understanding of the variabilities that are occurring. So it's this constant state of data starvation. And then, okay, that's one thing. That's painful. But there's nothing worse than being hungry and seeing a banquet, like standing outside of a restaurant and looking in the window and everybody's eating, you know, amazing food. And that is exactly what happens when products get released. So as, you know, we're developing a product, there's usually very few prototypes, and they're usually coming very late in the program, and they're usually accounted for. So it's very hard to do testing and get a lot of test units to generate the data you need. Well, then something happens. We turn on the manufacturing machine and we begin producing the products and sending them to the field. And they're being used by the customers, effectively test engineers using it in real life use cases. There is a tremendous amount of data, and it's all out there, and we're stuck looking at it through a glass window from inside the company, and it's salivating.
Not allowed to talk to them.
Salivating, and it's just all that data is out there, and you've taken all this time to create testing programs, and they've been stopped and shut down, and it's just this tragedy that we live over and over again. I'm not bitter.
Well, but you know, sometimes you ship the product and you hear nothing. It's crickets, right?
That's our fault. That's not the customers aren't. That's the thing. The customers aren't test engineers. We didn't hire them. We're not paying them. I mean, why would they take the time to get us the information? That's the point I'm going to get to. Is,
well,
there's
two reasons.
Arrogance that we think they care is crazy.
Well, there's that. But there's two types of people that will get in touch with you. The one that is ecstatic. They're your super fan. They love your product. And they want their additioning to be on your next commercial.
So a biased opinion. Okay, who's the other one?
And the other one is the one that came out of the box and it didn't work at all, you know, or it failed immediately, or it, you know, was disappointing in so many different ways. And they're like, hey, I want my $100 back.
But that's, and even so, it's crap data. How many of those do you get back? No fault found, because they didn't turn it on right or read them, you know, or there's all kinds of stuff.
It's their fault. Okay,
it's our fault, because we don't have any mechanism to even get the right information back. So this is what I'm getting at, is we don't have to live this way. This doesn't have to be the case. And it is so easy. And I don't understand why it's so hard to get leadership to see this. And they aren't doing it to be difficult or because their priorities are messed up. They just don't see the opportunity. So we need to show them the opportunity, and we need to show them it's not an epic endeavor, because that's a lot of the reason why you don't do it. You know, getting all that data collected correctly and from the field, you know, is a big effort. It's not free. It takes time. It takes money. And with the way product development programs go today, they move so fast that team's not even together anymore, right? They're on a new program. Yep. So what we need to do is, in the product development program, create the receptacle for receiving and processing that information. and integrated into the existing testing programs. So then what happens is you have a plug, basically an adapter that instantly, really easily plugs into the field data being generated. And it's not this awkward process of, oh, we want the field data. Okay, quality or complaints tries to collect it. And then where does it go? Who wants it? So-and-so isn't on the program anymore. Somebody has to process this. All that does not occur. Right. So it doesn't take a lot of work to, during the product development program, put the little bit of extra effort in to make sure that all the testing programs and analysis work you're doing is being structured in a way where it will easily plug into collecting field data. That's the first element.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And then I often find working with a new company, a new client, that I says, well, how's it doing in the field? And I says, well, we don't really know. That goes to the finance guys for the warranty stuff, where that's all outsourced to third-party repair shops. And all they send is a bill. We don't get any, you know, okay, we got to work this through.
Right.
The hard part oftentimes is just finding the data. And that data starvation part is a big piece of that. And then it gets into the details. Well, what failed? Well, we replaced 15 things, and we think one of them fixed it. Okay, which one? We don't know. We don't care. It's working now. Strip it.
You know? Right.
Yeah, there's,
so here's the second part.
There's tons of challenges there. Yeah.
Exactly. There's challenges. Here's the second part. So that's the first part. Have a place for the information to go and be processed and connect with the tools that the data turns the data into information. Here's the second part. Let's acknowledge the fact that it is a role. We are asking people in the field, our people and the customers, to be test engineers. It's a real role, and we need to acknowledge that. If we acknowledge that and respect that, it's going to be done better. So how do we do that? Well, you do real field trial programs where the customers engage and they get something out of it. They get access to new features. They get, you know, discounts. They get things where there's a kind of, you know, quid pro quo, so that they are doing due diligence, because we're going to be asking them to follow specific, you know, protocols for recording information. They can't just throw a box and say broken. That won't work.
That's beta programs. People have been doing beta, you know, with trusted client customers.
But it's too small. What if you expand
a million people? If with the Microsoft Windows a few years ago shipped a million beta copies to people, and they sent along, you know, here's what we're looking for, here's how to report it, here's what to do. But they had to go to those numbers because they were trying to ferret out these really odd connection pieces that they just couldn't do in-house.
So they're doing what I'm suggesting.
Exactly, yeah.
Great. So how come I interact with so many, we need to expand that. We need to get that message to more people and the value of it.
Yeah.
So I'm describing, you know, from the inside, how you see that, right? And you see Microsoft and you're like, oh, I wish I was working for them. They're getting the data back.
Yeah. Well, how about Tesla? With their cars.
Oh, they're phenomenal. But the thing is, though, there's something different about that, though. Now we're into the new modern day version of it, where it got much easier. The products will report back.
Yeah.
What's going on? You can cut the customer entirely out of it. And the products will report back forever. And the products can now do prognostics and preventive maintenance and change the whole customer experience entirely, mm-hmm. too.
So the customer gets a benefit for it.
It got even easier. There was a product. I mean, it's really amazing when you talk about things. I was working on a coffee maker, a rather complex one for home. But once you drop a Wi-Fi card in that, we just changed the most common failure mode to where customers throw out the product. They think it's worn out, but in fact, it hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And what occurs with coffee makers is if you have water that has minerals in it, those minerals build up on the heating elements.
Yep.
And that's a wild variable, right? I mean, depending on what kind of water customers have.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is it heats up slower and slower and slower because you've in fact encrusted the heating element with ceramic at that point.
Yeah.
And customers think the coffee maker is worn out and they throw it out. Well, here's the thing. That's very easy to monitor the rate that it's heating up. I mean, mm-hmm. it already does that with the thermocouple. So all you have to do is have the coffee maker, you know, now that you teach it, give it the degradation curve for mineral buildup, and it just simply sends a message back home, send this customer a, you know, descaling cartridge.
That's right.
And the customer gets a descaling cartridge, drops, you know, they're like, oh, all right, whatever. And they drop it in, and you now have a coffee maker that they think, you know, far exceeds the technology of anything previously for not wearing out. So yeah, we are in a new era now where the engagement to get the data, even with something like a coffee maker, not even a high-end, you know, car, has become quite easy. So it's even more foolish to not take advantage of that and do that. I mean, think about the sales. You know, somebody might argue, hey, you're putting Wi-Fi in a coffee, you're increasing our cost point or our profit, or, you know, cutting in our profit margin. But all you have to do is make the case for how many more sales you'll get and brand, you know, perception improvement, and how that's a no-brainer on as far as return on investment.
Yeah. Well, there's another piece to this, though, Adam. There's this. I had one client that the general manager of the group was confronting that he had 50% of his products shipped per year came back with customer complaints and failures. I mean, hard failures. I mean, actual components failing, like a compressor would just die. And he goes, well, customers always complain. That's just part of business. Okay. He's like, and his perception was, is that we only track how much it costs to replace that component. So they only had material costs in the repairs, not lost sales, not lost brand, not lost resources in the plant. They had to build 3 of these devices for every one they sold just to honor the warranty.
Yeah.
And just didn't get it. And he was spending millions to expand manufacturing. And he was interpreting it as that, oh, business is great. No,
right.
You get really good at replacing broken ones. That's all you're getting good at. And you're doing that gratis. And goes, well, the profit margin's great. We're still making money. I'm like, okay. Look at how much you're leaving on the table here, guy. But it was the part of getting ready to use field data is that you have to be receptive to hear field data. And you've seen it as people go, oh, that was at Adam's house. That's customer abuse. We're not going to deal with that.
Right, exactly.
But when 25% of your field failures are deemed, oh, customer, just they screwed up. Well, there's another message there if you're willing to see it. I think that's a part of this too, is that looking for field data or looking to receive it is you also have a crew that is willing to understand it and do something about it. There's too many products I run into where they say, well, we're not going to change it because it's already out. We're working on the next one. And then they don't take that learning either for the existing product or for the next product. And they go, well, that's out now. It's beyond our control.
Right. Well, that's the entire thing. Everything you've just described is not technology. It's attitude and perception of how to create a program and interface with the field, right? That executive needs, if he's not going to shift or learn, be removed if the company wants to stay competitive. I mean, that's a company that's ready for what I call the sideswipe. Mm-hmm. And the sideswipe is you've been very strong in a market for a long time, but have left tons of vulnerabilities. Yep. And somebody sees it and they come along. I mean, if you and I were in that same field that company's in, we see there's an easy opening here to grab a ton of their market share, right?
Yep.
All their customers are accepting a high failure rate, maybe because there's no other option. And then all of a sudden somebody shows up with an option and you're like, oh my God, these things don't have to fail half the time, you know? And
no, that's great. Let's use that.
Too late to react. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, no, I think that's a part of it, though, is the culture around failures. And you and I advocate all the time is that failures are golden, right? You want to learn from failures. And it's a great tool for us as engineers, as organizations, to continue to learn. If you're testing the past, you learn very little. If you ignore your test engineers / customers, then you're also not learning. Right. You're cutting off an avenue to really expand your knowledge. Now, one of the best scenarios I ever saw was a computer-ish type product, and it was relatively low volume. The ramp rate wasn't like an iPhone where they're going to make 10 million on launch day and have them out there. It was, you know, they launched 20 or 30 of them, and then the next week they'd have another 50, and then it would eventually get up to maybe a couple hundred a month kind of volumes. And not huge volumes because they were pretty specialized devices. And so they did all kinds of different things in the development process, and they knew that they needed to improve reliability. It was a big driver in why I heard about it. But then one of the things they did is they said, we're going to take 4 or 5 of our key developers, a mechanical engineer, electrical engineer, software engineer, and a handful of key folks that really know the whole system. And we're going to ship them with the product. So there were 5 units being installed, I think, in Israel. And usually this product had a technician that would help with the installation. It was a complicated product. And so they trained these engineers to stand quietly and observe. Don't fix anything unless it until it breaks, kind of thing. And they learned about how customers use their product. They learned the environments that were being put in. They got to see these things firsthand. But on their very first installation, their very first trip, they flew all these people internationally to go see, just watch this installation. And the power supply failed. And they handed the box to the electrical engineer. He opened it up and goes, oh, it's not meant to work in 220. This will only work at 120. And so they immediately called back. They shut down production. They reworked the power supplies. They had fast track to do changes. They had the design change before they left the client's location and changed it in production. So they didn't experience any more of those kinds of failures. But what they found over the 6 weeks that they followed installations going out is they were able to drive the field failure rate down fast, right? They were on top of solving those things. That's what they were meant to do. And it went lower than they'd ever seen that trajectory go before. So not only did they drive it down faster, they drove it further down. And it was, they were primed and ready to identify any anomaly and then deal with it. And yep. What an investment, right? To fly 4 or 5 engineers out to watch an installation.
Yeah, it's tremendous. I mean, there's products where that cost crossover makes sense. And then there's ones that would be pretty hard to do, right?
Well, the high volume stuff is we extrapolated that and we applied it into the high volume guys as we changed the call center trees, the responses to stuff. So the idea was to get, I was on the order of 100 units back. If there was a suspected hardware or software-hardware interaction, get the product back. Just FedEx them a new one, FedEx the one out, drive somebody out there to get it. Get the first 100 failures back. And then they had this dedicated team that wasn't traveling to individuals' homes for this product, but they were set up as the experienced folks that were carryover from the product, detailed to deal with those units come back, do the deep dive on the failure analysis and do design changes and extract the learnings of it. They weren't able to drive the failure rate down as fast because there's such a volume out there already right on day one. Yet what they did drive the failure rate down much quicker than what they would have normally have done. And they took away key learnings that went immediately into the next product because they were the key designers. And it's all too often is you take your best talent and get them onto the next product before you finish the old one. And then you pester them for the next 2 years to go back and fix the things that they didn't get a chance to get design right.
Oh, yeah. And the horrible thing is that's almost encouraged. It's rewarded twice. You know, if you design it and you get rewarded for time to market, cost point, features. You get your reward, you move on to the next project, and then you get called back as a hero to come save the day to fix the issues that, you know, weren't addressed. And executives have no idea. They're double incentivizing people to make poor reliability.
That's right. Whereas this idea of being selected for this team was perceived as a recognition of their talent. And those were the folks on the track to get promoted and to step up in their careers. So it was actually, and it was perceived as a stepping stone for career advancement.
Oh, you get all this time with the executives, tons of face time with the CEO who's very upset about the field issues, and you're the guy who can help. And yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible to see because the executives have no idea what they're doing to themselves, the self-sabotage and the culture they're creating.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, besides getting the data and setting up systems to be able to incorporate it and not have to go discover it or track it down, or, you know, I think Sarah's got that data under her desk, you know, next to the shredder. We better get to it before it falls in the shredder. Right. And then also having the capability to deal with it, right? To do the failure analysis, to learn from failures, to recognize that they're failures, not just customers complaining. And then there's the cultural part of being willing to get that information and deal with it.
Yeah.
I think those are all three parts. Any other parts I miss on that? Is that a
no? I think if we can address that, we'll be okay.
All right. So, you know, we threw out a handful of different examples and scenarios here, but hopefully it can comes together as a way for you as a listener to recognize that you could do this, right? You could put this in your program. Let us know how it goes. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. There's a contact form there for you. Or you can find our emails and phone numbers and stuff on our contact pages, and you can always get a hold of us through LinkedIn. We really do like hearing from you. It leads to so many of our discussions and episodes. So please feel free to join the conversation. So with that, Adam, let's go change some cultures. I think that's the charter for the day.
I am ready to go. And reliability culture will be out soon.
Is that the name of your book?
Reliability culture, being published by Wiley in just a few months. It'll be out, I think, for January or February. So I'm very excited because all these things I've experienced through all these years, you know, putting it in one place and make it easy to access. So it's exciting.
Cool. Yeah, no, that'd be great. All right. Cool, Adam. And good luck with the book launch. This episode will be out well in advance. Is there a place people can sign up if they're interested when it launches so they can be the first to know?
Well, you can, of course, go to my mailing list where it'll be shared. So you can go to apexridge.com and join the mailing list, which is at the bottom is the link, and you will be kept up to date.
Right, cool. There we go. Got a call to action in here at the last minute. All right. Thanks, Adam. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Take care. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.